every day for the past week she's left at exactly 3. She's just trying to make me look bad.
Things get dicey whenever a target suddenly changes their pattern. It's irritating and nerve-rattling, because that's when assassins make mistakes. Either the target changes their pattern, or the assassin changes his. Both scenarios end poorly. You make mistakes, you leave behind fatal evidence. The plot goes awry. And when plots go awry, assassins die. Why? When you retrace the events, it's always something very minor. A wallet left at home, running out of shampoo that morning, walking down an alley when a kid on a tricycle suddenly shoots out of nowhere. The woman was still in the shop. No matter, there was no way Resin was going to kill anyone today. But his heart was racing all the same. Anxiety was running through his nerve endings. She should have come out at 3 p.m. Resin would have followed her. Chong'an would have slowly paced them in his car. A little way ahead was a quiet side street where there were no security cameras for 200 meters. She always took that side street. Resin would have tapped her on the shoulder. If Resin had been her target, she would have recognized him at once. "Shall we go somewhere quiet to talk?" If she'd agreed, that would have been the end of it. No need for long explanations or threatening words, no need for his knife. Resin and Chong'an waited another 30 minutes in silence. At 4 p.m., Resin put on his black sunglasses and stomped over to the shop.
"Hey, wait!" Chong'an yelled. "You can't just storm into a convenience store with your knife out. Those places are full of security cameras."
"Welcome."
The woman covered the phone with one hand and greeted Resin loudly. Her voice was cheerful. Resin stood just inside the door and stared at her, but she turned away, showing no sign of recognizing him, and went right back to her phone call. Everyone in the shop could hear it.
"Oh, you know, that song that goes, 'Oops, I'm in love with my best friend's girl. What do I do?'"
"Yeah, that one." He was singing it like he was about to cry. And he kept shaking the tambourine even though it's a ballad. I almost died laughing. "Shut up. As if I'd do a duet with that guy." But then he gets the second part of the song and starts blubbering for real, like his friend's girlfriend had been whacked in the head with a hammer. He's a big guy too. I swear. What could I do? I put my arm around him and patted him on the shoulder. I felt like I had to. He put his head on my chest and tried to act like he was still crying, but I saw the way he looked at my miniskirt. He actually thought he was going to get me in the mood. I was like, "Are you kidding me?" Well, you know, I couldn't not kiss him, but that wasn't enough for this guy. No, it's not that I didn't want to. I just didn't want him to get the wrong idea about me. We just started dating. It'd be one thing if we'd gone back to a hotel, but in a karaoke room. This guy was clueless. No, no, he's not that bad. I mean, there's something cute about him, and he seems all right. Exactly. It's important to start off on the right foot. Once they get the wrong idea, there's no going back.
Resin was still standing in front of the door, staring at her. She glanced over at him. He took off his sunglasses.
"Hold on, don't hang up."
She covered the phone again and cocked her head at Resin.
"Sir, can I help you find something?"
she asked in a lilting voice. Her face bore no hint of fear or suspicion. Plotters always knew their targets' faces, just as assassins will recognize their targets anywhere. As soon as the plot is issued, you can't help staring at your target's photo every 3 minutes. It's the nerves. The target's face stays with you and continues to float around inside your head for weeks, even after you've killed the person. You see people on the street who look like that person, and you nearly jump out of your skin. You have recurring nightmares of running into whoever it was. This woman was no plotter. She was no assassin either. She was nothing. Who the hell was she? Had Chong'an made a mistake?
"Sir, can I help you?"
she asked again.
"What? Oh, candy bars. Where can I find the candy bars?"
Rezeng's mouth moved of its own accord.
"Candy bars? Over there to the left, second shelf from the top."
Her voice was still friendly. Why had he said candy bars? He didn't even like candy bars. Retting went to the shelf and grabbed two. He was thirsty, so he also grabbed a sports drink from the fridge. As he was closing the fridge door, he heard her say into the phone,
"Hey, let me call you back. I'll fill you in on the details in person."
She'd been on the phone for hours. What details could she possibly have left out? It was crazy. He would never understand women. He placed the candy bars and the sports drink next to the register.
"Big candy bar fan, huh?" she asked.
Rezin gave her a curt nod. He was in no mood for chit-chat.
"I like candy bars too, but I see you're buying two Snickers. Have you tried Heartbreak?"
"What?" Rezin stared at her.
"Heartbreak. Snickers is made for the American palate, but Heartbreak is made for ours, and it doesn't stick to your teeth, either. It offers a very high performance for its price, and it's only half the cost of a Snickers, though, of course, they've had to keep shrinking it so that they can keep the price the same as it was 10 years ago. That's the sad truth, but with everything else getting more and more expensive, I guess that's not so bad. So what do you think? Would you like to exchange one of your Snickers for a Heartbreak?"
The woman spoke so fast that Retting wasn't sure what she'd just said. He gathered that she told him she liked Heartbreak better. But so what? Who gave a shit whether she liked Heartbreak or not? Or whether it was half the price of a Snickers or not? Just shut up and take the money. "How much is this?" he asked, pointing at the Snickers.
1,001. Heartbreak is only 500 won.
She held up five fingers. She gave him a playful smile. Retting put one of the Snickers back and grabbed a Heartbreak. Eager to get it over with, he opened his wallet.
"You won't regret it."
The woman held her fist up in the air.
"Heartbreak!"
"Thank you very much."
"Ha ha, ha ha. No thanks necessary."
"It's important to share valuable information with your fellow countrymen," she laughed heartily, as if they'd just met in the middle of the Siberian wilderness.
When Retting left the convenience store, Chong'un was parked in front with the engine running. He looked worried. Retting opened the door and got in.
"What happened?"
Chong'un asked impatiently. Retting threw the Heartbreak at his face. It bounced off Chong'un's forehead and fell in his lap.
"What's this?"
"What's it look like? It's a candy bar. It'll fill you with brotherly love." Chong'un frowned and ripped open the wrapper.
"You marched in there like you were going to take down a bull with a kitchen knife, but all you came back with was one candy bar."
"Two, actually." Retting opened the sports drink and took a swig. "She's no plotter. Definitely not an assassin either. She didn't recognize me."
"She didn't?"
Chong'un looked incredulous. Retting nodded. Chong'un took out the ceramic bomb casing and examined it.
"We know this was made by an amateur, which means she can't be an expert device maker either. So who is she?"
"Are you sure it was her?" Retting asked, skeptically.
"What am I, a rookie? I told you, she definitely ordered three of the parts."
Retting stared at the convenience store. The woman was talking to the younger employee who'd come for the shift change. After a moment, the younger employee looked at her watch, bowed several times to the woman, and left.
"Looks like she's taking that girl's shift," Retting said. "I swear, she's messing with everyone's schedules today."
"Looks that way, doesn't it? Typical. Why can't people stick to what they're supposed to do? Why do they have to mess up other people's plans? That's why our country's so backward. You need more than freeways and skyscrapers to be a developed country. You have to develop the right mindset first, damn it."
"What does any of this have to do with being a developed country?"
Retting unwrapped his Snickers and took a bite. Chang'an's eyes widened.
"Hey, how come your bar is different from mine?"
"Mine was made in the USA. Yours was made here. Mine was 1,001, yours was 500.
"Son of a..."
Chang'an pouted.
"Why'd you buy me the cheap one? You know I prefer American stuff."
Retting handed him his candy bar. Chong'un grinned like a child as they swapped. Dig deeper into her background. Her job, her parents, her younger sister, the lab where she used to work, her bank transactions, anything and everything you can find.
What? You expect me to do all that in exchange for one lousy candy bar? And with what budget? My prices have gone up, man. There's a little thing called market value, you know.
Your buddy's in peril, and here you are crowing about market value.
Fine. I'll do it as long as you call me elder brother, because I am far too humane to abandon a little brother in danger. And let's be real, I am 2 years older than you.
Resen glared at him. When he didn't look away, Chuan tapped him on the shoulder and gave him a look that said, "Can't you take a joke?" "Please, elder brother," Resen said, his voice flat. Chuan looked at him, feigning disgust.
"Holy shit, where's your pride? What a pushover. You really need to man up."
By the time he'd finished buying cat food and cat snacks at the pet shop and was on his way home, it was nearly dark. Resen checked his mailbox in the lobby, bills and junk mail. He turned to go upstairs, but someone was sitting on the bottom step, slumped forward and half asleep. One hand was wrapped in bandages, the other was holding a department store gift bag. Resen leaned down to look at the man's face. It was Minari Park. Resen shook him by the shoulder. His eyes flew open and he looked around in bewilderment, and then let out a big yawn and stood with a grunt.
"What are you doing here?" Resen asked. "I came to see you."
"You should have called first."
"I just figured I'd drop by."
"Let's go inside."
"No, no, I'm fine here."
Minari waved his bandaged hand and grimaced.
"How are your fingers?" "They're okay. Got them reattached. Medical technology these days. I didn't think the doctors could do it, even though I ran straight to the hospital with my fingers. But what do you know? They're stuck right back on, like a lizard's tail growing back." "Yeah, a lizard's tail."
Minari murmured the words "lizard's tail" again under his breath, evidently impressed by his own imagery. He turned his bandaged hand to show Resen. Then he said,
"Oh yeah, this,"
as if he'd nearly forgotten something important, and handed Resen the bag.
"What is it?" "Chukbang anchovies. I know how much you like beer, and there's no better snack for a cold beer than dried anchovies. I got them from the department store, just like the set I got Old Raccoon, from Namhae's signature collection. Very expensive."
Minari looked flustered. Resen raised an eyebrow. Why had Minari come all this way to bring him a gift?
"You're giving me a present after I cut your fingers off. I didn't even visit you in the hospital. Now I feel really bad." "Oh, no, no, don't feel like that. It's the rest of us who should be feeling bad for how we treated Old Raccoon. That wasn't right. In fact, he's the reason we're living as well as we are. I know how kind he's been to me, but little guys like us don't have it easy. Everyone's been tightening their belts down to the first notch, but it's still hard to make ends meet. We haven't forgotten our place or anything. It's just that life keeps closing in on us."
Minari took out a cigarette, but struggled to work the lighter with his left hand. Resen took out his own lighter and lit the cigarette for him. Minari took a deep drag and looked Resen up and down.
"What did Old Raccoon say?"
"About what? My cutting off your fingers?"
"No, not that. About us going to work for Hanja. I figured Old Raccoon must know about it by now. Of course, we're all independent businessmen with our own gigs, so I can't exactly say we're completely under Hanja's wing. Even so, I still feel bad about it."
"That's why you're here, to test the winds."
"Not exactly," Minari said, falteringly. "It's only part of the reason."
Minari stared out at the streetlight as he finished his cigarette. Every now and then, he looked like he was about to say something, but then he clammed up. After a long pause, he dropped his cigarette and stubbed it out under his shoe. There was something clownish about his stiffly ironed grey trousers and his shiny, polished red shoes. Minari glanced at Resen and made a sad face.
"Lately, the guys have all been talking about a war brewing between Hanja and the doghouse. A real war, like in the old days. That'll get messy. Detectives and prosecutors will be crawling all over us and cracking down while the plotters take out everyone just to save their own asses. Desperate assassins will be roaming around like wild dogs, picking fights with everyone for no reason. The few customers I have left will dry up. I'll be out of business. In the end, only the little guys like us are fucked. Resing, I am too old to get caught up in this fight. Old Raccoon and Hunja are tough, ambitious. They'll do whatever they have to do to save their pride. But what about us in the middle? If we side with Hunja, we have to watch out for Old Raccoon. If we so much as gesture at the library, we have to watch out for Hunja. We're between a rock and a hard place. And I tell you, I'm too old for this. I'm scared. You know I'm not the ambitious type. I'm just trying to get by.
What's your point?
Hunja wants to see you. Just meet with him once.
Rezeng narrowed his eyes. And if I do?
You know you can't have two tigers on one mountain. Let's be honest, the library doesn't stand a chance against Hunja. It's not like the old days. If war breaks out, we're all dead. Old Raccoon, definitely dead. You and me, too. And Hunja doesn't stand to gain anything from it either. We did all the work to build our businesses, but because of this election, someone else will get the credit.
Rezeng hurled the Jukbang anchovy gift bag at Minari Pak's feet. You think a few lousy anchovies can make up for telling me to stab Old Raccoon in the back? Minari looked shocked as he scrambled to pick up the bag.
Don't you know how expensive these are?
He muttered. Pouting, he held up the bag to his ear and gave it a shake, stroking it as if handling an antique vase. Then he made the same sad face as before.
I'm not telling you to sell out Old Raccoon. I'm just saying how things are. It's been a long time since the library had work for us. Businessmen don't wait around, you know that. There's no such thing as loyalty in our line of work. Old times, favors, that doesn't go far. People always go where the money is. Old Raccoon is getting on in years and he never leaves the library, so he doesn't know how things are changing. If war breaks out, everyone will take Hanja's side. That's what it has come to. There won't be a fight. That's why you need to go and see Hunja, because you're Old Raccoon's hands and feet. If the conversation goes well between you and Hunja, there'll be no need for war. Old Raccoon can quietly retire to the countryside and live out the rest of his life in peace. And we'll be able to grow our businesses in peace as well. Everybody wins.
Rezeng pictured the general in his mountain cottage with his old dog, Santa. Someone must have said the same thing to him when he was stepping down. Move to a quiet place in the country and enjoy your remaining years. It's a win-win all around. What do they mean by that? Growing flowers, planting potatoes, raising a dog, and choosing your final resting place? Basking in the warm afternoon sun, your eyelids the only part of you still moving, like you're some kind of aging, ailing elephant. Or moving into a nursing home, where the only thing to occupy your time is tedious chit-chat with old people you have absolutely nothing in common with, or playing endless games of cards and stealing stones from the communal paddock board for your growing collection of useless things. Those days would repeat themselves ad nauseam until death finally came creeping into your room one night like an assassin. Minari Pak was still holding out the anchovies. Rezeng looked at the bag quivering awkwardly in his hand.
Just take it, Minari said. Signature collection.
Give them to your wife, or to Hunja, I don't care. What makes you think I could stomach those?
If you insist on being this stubborn, Hunja will have no choice but to eliminate you.
Is that a threat? Rezeng glowered at Minari.
Please don't make things difficult. This fight doesn't have to happen. I'm telling you this as someone twice your age. Kissing ass is better than being an ass.
Minari set the anchovies at Rezeng's feet and slowly turned and walked out. Rezeng stared down at the bag. All at once, he thought, Old Raccoon must be so lonely. The businessmen who used to take gifts to the library every holiday had all turned their backs on him. This was Hunja's world now. How much longer would Reseng live if he went to see him? 3 years? 5? Maybe longer. Maybe he'd even live out his natural years if he got on his knees and started kissing ass like Minari Park. Sure, nothing wrong with a little ass in your face. Not like honor and dignity had ever mattered to him. Old Raccoon liked to joke that the only reason he'd brought Reseng home from the orphanage was so he'd have something to lean on when he walked. He said it to ruffle Reseng's feathers, but when Reseng thought about it, there was a certain truth to it. He'd been Old Raccoon's crutch ever since he was 11. He fetched books from shelves, ran errands in the meat market, delivered letters from a faceless plotter who slipped him envelopes from behind a door. And after the death of Old Raccoon's longtime assassin, Trainer, Reseng did all the assassination work as well. If Reseng were to turn his back on him now, Old Raccoon would be left to hobble along without a crutch. I guess that's not the worst thing that can happen to someone in this line of work, Reseng muttered. When Trainer was killed 10 years ago, Old Raccoon did nothing. He kept quiet, despite the rumors that Hanja was behind it. Things were different then. Old Raccoon was still on top, and yet there was no retaliation, no punishment, no investigation. Old Raccoon didn't even get angry, even though Trainer had stood by him for 3 decades. He'd simply washed Trainer's body with its multiple stab wounds from what had clearly been a vicious battle, and quietly cremated him in Bear's incinerator. It was a gloomy funeral. Reseng had been the only mourner with Old Raccoon, who had silently scattered Trainer's ashes from the top of a windswept hill. "Aren't you going to do something about it?" Reseng had asked.
"That's how it is for assassins. You can't knock over the chessboard just because you lost a pawn."
That's how it is. Those were Old Raccoon's parting words for the man who'd stood by his side for 30 years. Reseng had learned everything from Trainer: how to handle firearms, how to use a knife, how to build and defuse bombs, how to set up a booby trap, how to track and hunt prey, even how to throw a boomerang. After the Vietnam War, Trainer found work with a private military company abroad and traveled to war zones all over the world. He had a gentle face, which made it hard to believe his claim of having killed hundreds of people on the battlefield, and he loved housework. Despite his huge body, his hands were deceptively nimble. He made all his own equipment. Everything he built was done with care and precision, and he was an excellent cook. He particularly enjoyed doing laundry. On sunny days, without fail, he would hand wash all the sheets and curtains and hang them on the clothesline in the courtyard. With a cigarette dangling from his lips, his face a picture of contentment, he would watch the sheets billowing in the wind and say, "If only I could get my life that clean." If only he could have scrubbed his life clean. He could have married a nice girl, raised kids, and led a peaceful family life, doing the cooking, cleaning, and laundering he so enjoyed. But unfortunately, life is not a set of sheets. You cannot scrub away your past, your memories, your mistakes, or your regrets. And so you die with them. Like Old Raccoon said, that's how it was for assassins. Reseng picked up the anchovy gift set and went upstairs. When he opened the door, Desk and Lampshade came running to greet him, rubbing against his calves. Reseng filled their dishes with the chicken soup he'd bought them at the pet shop. The cats purred as they lapped up the soup. He patted their heads. "Do you know how rough your alley cat sisters have it? If I toss you out, you scaredy cats won't last a week. It's hell out there." The cat cafe was called Like Cats. When Reseng sat down, Desk and Lampshade started meowing inside the cat carrier. He opened the latch, but they took one look at the dozens of other cats roaming around the cafe and refused to budge. The cafe owner brought him a cup of coffee.
"Ooh, look who's come to visit. Is that Desk and Lampshade?" she asked excitedly.
His cats were clearly happy to meet her. They purred and came right out of the carrier. All cats seemed to love this cafe owner instantly, What was her secret? After getting married, she started raising more than 20 cats at home. But as the number of cats increased, her husband couldn't stand it and told her she had to choose him or the cats. And just like that, she divorced him and moved out. At gatherings of the Cat Cafe members, she would laugh and tell the story again.
Can you believe he asked me to choose? Ha! You finally brought them, after all the times I've asked you to,
the cafe owner exclaimed as she played with Reseng's cats.
Is it a special occasion?
Reseng took an envelope from his jacket pocket and handed it to her. Looking at him quizzically, she took out 2 1 million won bank checks. I'd be really grateful if you would look after them for me, Reseng said. It might be for a little while or for a very long while. It's also possible I might never come back to get them.
Are you taking a trip somewhere far away? Are you going abroad?
It's not that far, but I'm not sure where this trip will end. She nodded, as if she understood.
We all have our dark spells now and then, she said, handing the envelope back to him. I understand what you're going through, but this isn't necessary. I'll look after your cats anyway until you come back.
Since you know what I'm going through, please take the money. He lowered his head in a gesture of pleading. The envelope sat between them in the middle of the table. She looked at it and, after a long pause, nodded.
When I was your age, I went very far away once too. I went so far away, I didn't think I'd be able to get back. But when you do finally come back, you realize you weren't nearly as far away as you'd feared.
Reseng patted Desk and Lampshade, who nipped playfully at his hands. They already seemed at home there. He stood and said goodbye to the cafe owner.
Good luck, she said.
Thank you. Reseng gave Desk and Lampshade one last pat and slowly walked out of Like Cats. Reseng took a cab to the L Life Insurance building in Gangnam. Hanja's offices were on the 7th, 8th, and 9th floors. Rumor had it that around 17 different company addresses were registered there. As if it wasn't ironic enough that the country's top assassination provider was brazenly running his business in a building owned by an international life insurance company, the same assassination provider was also simultaneously managing a bodyguard firm and a security firm. But just as a vaccine company facing bankruptcy will ultimately survive not by making the world's greatest vaccine, but rather the world's worst virus, so, too, did bodyguard and security firms need the world's most evil terrorists in order to prosper, not the greatest security experts. That was capitalism. Hanja understood how the world could curl around and bite its own tail like the Ouroboros serpent, and he knew how to translate that into business and extract the maximum revenue. There was no better business model than owning both the virus and the vaccine. With one hand, you parceled out fear and instability, and with the other, you guaranteed safety and peace. A business like that would never go under. Reseng took the elevator to the 7th floor. Hanja's office was on the 9th floor, but to reach it, you had to get off on the 7th floor and pass through the type of metal detector you'd expect to find in an airport. As Reseng walked through, an alarm shrieked. A female employee in a black suit came up to him with a handheld metal detector. She greeted him politely and asked him to raise his arms. He did as he was asked. As soon as the handheld detector came near him, it started beeping. He reached into his inner jacket pocket, pulled out Chu's hand pills in its leather sheath, and placed it in a basket. She looked at him in shock. I was cooking just before I left. Must have forgotten to put it away first. I'm so damn absent-minded, he said with a smile. The flustered employee glanced back, and a husky security guard came over, a taser and a tear gas gun strapped to his belt. What seems to be the problem? He narrowed his eyes and looked Reseng up and down. The way his uniform squeezed his rolls of fat reminded Reseng of a pack of hot dogs. He had the build of a nightclub bouncer, and his shoulders were tensed. Reseng almost felt sorry for him as he handed over Hanja's gold-embossed business card. Do you have an appointment? No. Who shall I say is here? Tell him I'm from the doghouse. After a brief wait, a woman came up to him and introduced herself as Hanja's secretary. She had a polished, intellectual look about her. She guided him to a separate elevator that served only the three floors leased to Hanja. They got off on the 9th floor and went into a room marked VIP Lounge. As he sat down, the secretary asked in a businesslike voice, "Can I get you a drink? Tea, coffee, water? We also have alcohol if you prefer." "No, thank you. I had something right before I came here. Is this room non-smoking?" He looked around. There were no ashtrays. "According to the rules, yes. The entire building is a no-smoking zone." Rezing frowned, and she smiled furtively. Her tone softened as she said, "Well, rules are made to be broken." "In that case, would you mind bringing me an ashtray?"
"It'll be about 30 minutes before the boss can join you. Do you mind waiting?"
"No, that's fine," he said with a nod. When the ashtray arrived, Rezing lit a cigarette and took a long look around the spacious room. In keeping with Hanja's preference for the immaculate, there were no decorations apart from a single picture on the wall. Rezing picked up the ashtray and moved to the window so he could look outside. All 10 lanes of Tehran Boulevard were jammed with cars. It seemed strange to him, the luxurious digs of an assassination provider bang in the heart of the Republic of Korea. The fact that Hanja's office was on this street, with its sky-high rent, meant that the country's economic hub was desperate for contract killers. Rezing was on his third cigarette when Hanja finally came in.
"Sorry to keep you waiting. You really should have called first."
Hanja's attempt at an expression of regret came off as more terrifying than apologetic. He took a seat on the couch as his secretary came back in.
"Don't you want anything? I'm having a drink. It's not every day I receive such a special guest."
Hanja sounded more buoyant than usual. His secretary looked at Rezing, who hesitated. This strange hospitality made him uncomfortable.
"Do you have Jack Daniels?" Rezing asked the secretary. She nodded.
"I'll have the same," Hanja said. "On the rocks."
After the secretary left, Hanja kept glancing nervously around the room, as if expecting someone else to be there. He was trying to pass it off as excitement from being in a good mood, but it wasn't working. Considering that they were on his turf, where he called the shots, who or what could possibly have been after him? Rezing was suddenly dying to know. The two of them sat in awkward silence until the secretary came back with their drinks.
"I'm really glad you're here. I was worried you wouldn't come."
Hanja raised his glass in a toast, but Rezing didn't reciprocate. Hanja looked at his lone glass held aloft and took an embarrassed sip.
"What are you after?" Rezing asked bluntly. "The doghouse? Old raccoon's life?"
Hanja leaned his head back and laughed.
"What would I want with a musty library full of second-hand books, or some decrepit old man's life, for that matter?"
"That's what everyone's saying."
"Damn those rumors."
Hanja raised his glass and took a sip, then said,
"You know, old raccoon was the one who taught me never to kill anyone unless I was paid fairly. That's the sort of wisdom all contractors should carve into their brains. Honor, faith, friendship, loyalty, revenge, love, saving face. None of those reasons matter, because no decent contractor will kill someone unless there's profit to be made. So what sort of profit would be coming to me if I killed old raccoon? I mean, sure, some good would come of it. Fewer headaches, for one. But on the whole, when you crunch the numbers, there's nothing in it for me. Old raccoon might wish that on me, but I'm not stupid."
"I don't care about your number crunching."
"You should care about it. Killing you would net me quite a profit, as would killing your mate Chang'an."
Hanja drained his glass.
"I had no idea I was so valuable," Rezing said as he took a sip. The distinctive aroma of Jack Daniels filled his sinuses.
Hanja sneered at him.
"Don't get the wrong idea. You're not. You simply occupy a unique position. What about my position? The big money is in politics, but the old geezers who pull those strings refuse to trust anyone but old Raccoon. They have some sort of nostalgia for the library. Or maybe they don't trust anything that's less than 100 years old. Either way, it's a joke. Since when does tradition matter to a contractor? But that's how old men are. They're suspicious and they hate change. It's frustrating, but what can you do? That's reality. So what I need is a dead Sugar Liang. Resen gave him a quizzical look. In the Battle of Wujiang Plains, Hanja explained, after General Zhuge died, his army carved a wooden statue that looked just like him and used it to trick Sima Yi's army into thinking he was still alive, which scared them off. But a living Zhuge Liang is too much. There's no telling what he'll do. If old Raccoon just stayed nice and quiet in that doghouse of his, I wouldn't have any complaints. Since you and I grew up in the library too, it makes sense for us to continue the old fart's legacy. And it's a nice little business. But the problem is that you're not letting him rest in peace.
Rest in peace. Resing slowly echoed Hanja's choice of words.
You're his hands and feet. And that drip Chang'an is his eyes and ears. Chang'an is always bringing the old man information. He's like a mother sparrow feeding worms to a baby sparrow, while you run around wiping his ass for him. I'll be honest, I was pretty annoyed with you for bringing the old general back in an urn.
So? Resen glowered.
So?
Hanja sneered.
So, killing old Raccoon won't make for more business, but at the same time, I can't not finish what I started. What to do? It's really tragic, but I have to axe something. Sometimes, to keep the body alive, you have to chop off part of it, like a hand, or a foot, or an ear.
Is that why you killed Traina? Hanja's face flushed. He was quiet for a moment, stroking his chin.
Seems you still don't know the difference between what's okay to talk about and what isn't.
Hanja was about to say something more, but stopped himself. He picked up the phone and asked his secretary to bring him another glass of whiskey. She came in, put down the new glass, and took away the empty one. Hanja took a sip.
I know you have it in for me because of that. He was like a father to you and an older brother to me. I learned everything I know from Trainer too. But the world is much more complicated than you think. We have to do what we can to survive in this incomprehensible place.
I don't care what kind of world this is. What's the benefit of killing family members? So you can afford a fancy office.
Hanja glared at him. Don't tell me you think we're actually family. Who's related? You and old Raccoon? Me and old Raccoon? That's a big fucking joke. You know as well as I do that we were just his crutches, to be used and then thrown away. You seem confused, so I'll try to make things clear for you. If you were knifed right now and got carted off to bears, old Raccoon wouldn't even blink an eye. He'd simply find himself a new crutch. I learned that 20 years ago. But you, boy wonder, still don't get it.
Hanja took another sip. Resing scowled at him. Hanja turned to the window. He looked annoyed. The conversation was apparently not going the way he'd hoped it would. The phone buzzed.
All right, tell him I'll be there in 10 minutes.
He hung up. Resen lit a cigarette. Hanja checked his watch.
It's B, from the National Assembly. His idiot son is constantly in trouble, but the kid got what he deserved this time. He trapped a girl in his hotel room, tried to force his dick into her mouth, but she bit it. Sank her teeth in it so hard, he said it was barely hanging on by the skin. Good for her.
Hanja gave Resen a mischievous look.
I'm guessing a dick is not as easy to reattach as fingers, huh? A few days ago, B came to see me, crying about how his darling boy, the apple of his eye, the only son born to an only son of an only son, had his dick bitten off, and with it all hope of his carrying on the family name.
He grabbed my hand and said I was the only one who could make things right. It was so embarrassing. Like you said, I built this fancy office right in the heart of Gangnam, and I seem to be living well. But the truth is, what can I do? If I want to make ends meet, I have to help lick his wounds. If a national assemblyman of the Republic of Korea can air his dirty laundry in front of me, then how dare a lowly contractor like myself say, "Oh no, I could never stoop so low." I'd be too afraid. My life is no different from everyone else's. That's why you should put away your pride and join me. You'll live, and your friend Jong-un will live, and thankfully, I'll live too. I'm not asking you to do much. Just stay at the library, but give me a call whenever work comes in. Hanja's eyes were fixed on Reseng's. Reseng puffed on his cigarette and said nothing. Hanja's smile slowly disappeared, and his face hardened. "Election's right around the corner," he said. "This is a sensitive time. Everyone's running around trying to get their share. Lethal mistakes can happen. Did you know that the D Group had over 20 subsidiaries, but it took the government prosecutors less than 6 months to dismantle all of it? Their only crime was refusing to help fund a political party during the elections. If people like us make a mistake, we'll be dead and dismembered before we hit the ground. Just thinking about it makes my head hurt. So don't complicate things. I don't want to kill you. But if you keep resisting me, I'll have no choice."
"We still don't know who'll end up with a knife in the stomach," Reseng said weakly.
"You're right. We don't. But you can't be in this business if you're not prepared to get knifed at some point. Are you prepared?"
The phone rang again.
"Be right there," Hanja said, and hung up. "I have to go. Behave yourself, and tell your friend Jong-un what I said."
"Did you put a bomb in my toilet?" Reseng asked the question as Hanja was walking away. Hanja turned, a confused look on his face. After a second, he caught on and assumed a look of wounded pride.
"Do I look like I have time to be sticking my hand in your filthy toilet?"
Hanja shut the door behind him. Reseng sat down and finished his cigarette. His mind was filled with too many thoughts at once. He stubbed out the cigarette and took the elevator back to the 7th floor. The woman in the black suit took Chu's Henkels out of his cubbyhole and gave it back to him. The pack of hot dogs stared at him and tried to look tough. As Reseng looked down at Chu's knife, a sense of shame settled over his shoulders. He put the knife in his pocket. Then he took the elevator the rest of the way down and rushed out of the building. He couldn't get away fast enough. Reseng returned home, but desk and lampshade were no longer there to rub against his leg as he came in. He stood in the doorway for a moment and stared blankly around at his apartment. The only things missing were the two cats, and yet the whole place felt empty. He took off his shoes and went in. The empty cat dishes were sitting under the table. He stared at them for a moment and then opened the cabinet, took out the cat food, and filled the bowls to the top. He decided to run a hot bath. Though he hadn't done much, he felt exhausted, and his body ached as if he'd been beaten with a hammer. As he watched steam rise from the tub, he felt helpless, useless, as if he were a cog that had been spit out of a clock, a cog that had once been an integral working part, only to find itself now staring at the complex inner mechanism that kept right on ticking without it. Every time Reseng came home from a kill, he was filled with inertia. He had no idea why. It wasn't guilt, nor was it displeasure or self-loathing. It was inertia, pure and simple. An overpowering sense that he could no longer be responsible for anyone, let alone himself. Everything seemed too hard, chatting and laughing with others, meeting women and going on dates, having a hobby, building a model boat, even cooking dinner. The only life he could manage was one of drinking can after can of beer until he was drunk, staring out the window through unfocused eyes, or lying in bed, staring at the patterns on the ceiling and wallpaper, until he couldn't take the hunger anymore and grabbed whatever he found in the fridge before falling back to sleep. It was only natural.
What would be really strange, he thought, was if someone who earned their living by killing others felt revitalized by it. As he lay in the hot bath and watched condensation form on the ceiling, Reseng pondered Hanja's, Old Raccoon's, and Minari Park's math. Everyone had their own particular way of keeping accounts. Even the small-time businessmen of the meat market, the disposables, and the washed-up assassins who'd sunk as low as they could go all walked around doing their own private calculations. Whether they got the numbers right or wrong in the end, they based their ambitions, their movements, their fears, and their kills on their own math. As he picked up a handful of soap bubbles floating in the tub, Reseng wondered about Old Raccoon's math. It made no sense to him at all. He dunked his head under the water and started adding up the number of people he'd killed so far. As he did so, he was overcome with a sense of ruin. Chong'an showed up around midnight. The doorbell woke Reseng from a deep sleep. He opened the door with his eyes half closed. Chong'an looked annoyed.
You're sleeping? Must be nice. Meanwhile, I've been hopping all over the place in the middle of the night like a frog in a frying pan.
He looked around as he stepped into the apartment.
Desk, lampshade. Get out here with those stupid names of yours. I know you've been pining away to see Mr. Handsome, and now here I am.
Chong'an looked inside the cat tower, under the couch, and behind the curtains.
Where are those girls? Why are they so shy all of a sudden?
I sent them away.
Where?
Somewhere better than here.
What place could possibly be better than their master's loving arms?
If I get knifed in the street, they'll starve to death. Chong'an stared at Reseng in shock, then laughed.
You idiot. No one's going to... Don't worry. Elder brother just finished a very thorough investigation.
He pulled a thick manila envelope from his bag and put it on the table.
You've heard of Dr. Kang Ji-kyung?
Chong'an asked. The forensic pathologist?
Yeah. He worked at the National Forensic Service for a long time. Turns out, he was a plotter. I'd always wondered about him. Every time I saw his picture in the paper, I got this funny feeling.
Why is that?
That place had a disturbing history. Back when all those meathead military guys were in power, they didn't need any fancy plots, only signatures.
Signatures?
They didn't hire any fancy plotters because they could just sweet-talk medical examiners into signing falsified death certificates for them. The Agency for National Security Planning could beat the shit out of people all they wanted. But as long as the medical examiner wrote that the cause of death was suicide and signed it, case closed. They had it pretty sweet compared to plotters nowadays, who freak out about even leaving the slightest bit of evidence behind. Anyway, that's how those guys got into the business. At first, the medical examiners had no choice but to sign the paperwork, because they had their wives and children to think about, and the military had so much power. But once they got sucked into it, they sank deeper and deeper. You think the contractors would let them just walk away? You know what they're like.
But what's the deal with this Dr. Kang?
Mito, that woman from the convenience store, was his lab assistant.
Reseng nodded. I get the idea.
Just the idea. The answer's right there. Who do you think a hotshot like Dr. Kang would work with? Minari Park? Yeah, right. He would work with Hanja or Old Raccoon. But now that Old Raccoon has practically retired, it's very likely that he was Hanja's plotter.
Reseng lit a cigarette. He wasn't convinced about Hanja or Old Raccoon. Besides, he and this Dr. Kang had never crossed paths. And even if they had, why would a plotter of his stature bother to plant a bomb in the toilet of some lowly assassin? What does Dr. Kang do these days? Reseng asked.
He died recently.
Died?
Yeah, and they say it was suicide. Can you believe it? Someone who spent his whole life officially passing off murder as suicide turns around and commits suicide himself. Suspicious, right?
How'd he die?
Jumped off a roof. Or someone dropped him off a roof. He weighed over 100 kilograms, so it had to be a pretty strong someone.
Chong'an handed him a stack of photos taken at the scene of the accident. An overweight man was sprawled on the ground like a lump of wet clay. His skull was crushed, and his right shoulder and neck were broken so badly that his head was twisted all the way round. The pool of blood around him was a dark cherry red against the stark white of the lab coat he was still wearing when he died. Stranger still, lying on top of the dried blood was a single slipper.
"He only fell 5 stories, but what a mess," Chang'an said. "The bigger they are, you know. He had a good appetite for someone who did autopsies all day. He wasn't that tall, so he must have really been packing it in. He should have watched what he ate."
"Where'd you get these photos?"
"Where do you think? From the cops. Cops nowadays are nice to people."
"He killed himself in his slippers," Rezeng tilted his head. "The official cause of death was suicide."
"You know how cops are. They'll do whatever it takes to lighten their caseload. Also, he left a will, and there were no signs of homicide."
"What did the will say?" Chang'an flipped through the papers and extracted a single photocopied sheet.
"I'm sorry for all the lives I ruined and the people I hurt. I am ashamed of myself," he read.
"A crisis of conscience," Rezeng said.
"Ha! That guy never had a conscience. The people at his funeral looked like they were celebrating. Might as well have been a wedding."
Rezeng took a drag on his cigarette. Plotters sometimes became targets. They made mistakes too, just like assassins. They left clues. They got caught. But they were always eliminated quietly, because unlike assassins, who never had information to give no matter how far you dug, once a plotter surfaced, the past he'd buried surfaced right along with him. Plotters had to be killed more carefully, more covertly, and more quietly than any other target. That was the unwritten law of this world.
"Who killed him?" Rezeng asked. "I think it was her."
Chang'an held up a photograph of Mito. Rezeng laughed.
"Oh, sure. That tiny chatterbox would have no problem killing a guy that size. Let me guess. She knocked him out with a hot break to the head, then called up her gorilla of a boyfriend to toss him off the roof. Fine. Let's say it was her. Why she do it?"
"I don't know, but there's something very, very fishy about her. You and I both know plotters never use their own names. And they keep everything separate. The address where their mail goes, the secret hideout where they hatch their plots, their secret rendezvous with brokers, different places, so it won't all blow up in their face at once. Plus, they use a different name in each place. But this woman ordered bomb parts in her own name."
"Maybe Dr. Kang used her address."
"Why bother when there are more than enough fake names and registration numbers to go around?"
Rezeng stared at the photograph of Mito. Her face turned to the sky, smiling. She looked naive, almost simple. The sort of girl who'd shriek at the sight of a cockroach. He couldn't believe she was behind any of this. Even if Chang'an was right, none of it added up. Given Dr. Kang's life, he would have had plenty of enemies. Mito could have been one of them, and she might have killed him because of it. But what did that have to do with Rezeng and her planting a bomb in his toilet? It made no sense. "I think you've just got the hots for her," Rezeng said, tossing the photos on the table. "You're barking up the wrong tree." Chang'an looked exasperated.
"You don't know her. She's scary. According to the people who work in the marketplace where she grew up, she worked non-stop, delivering milk, newspapers, doing odd jobs for everyone, from the fish shop to the greengrocer, in order to support her sister, who's in a wheelchair, and put herself through school, all while maintaining a perfect GPA. Everyone I met kept praising her and saying she was sent from heaven. They said she was so smart and pretty and nice and honest and hardworking that they all chipped in a bit of money each month to help pay for her education. And even though she was up at dawn every morning to work at the market, she still graduated top of her class in medical school too. That's scary."
Chang'an looked positively enamored. "Girls with perfect GPAs are scary."
"Oh, come on, that's not what I mean. What I'm saying is, why work as a plotter's assistant after all that? Her hard times were behind her. She got into Korea's best medical school."
"Medical school's expensive, and plotting is an easy way to make a good pile of cash."
But this woman, Mito, isn't that simple. I've shadowed hundreds of people, dated dozens of women. I basically have a PhD in women. Why don't you get me?
Fine. Then why would such an honest, hard-working woman kill a doctor and plant a bomb in my toilet? That makes no sense.
We don't have the whole picture yet, but we will soon. I can feel it.
Chang'an rummaged in his bag and pulled out a map. He handed it to Ressing. What's this?
I've circled the most likely locations of Dr. Gang's and Mito's secret hideouts. You should check them out.
What about you?
I have plans. I'll be back in a week.
What plans?
It's a secret.
Chang'an grinned. You're going on vacation with some girl while your friend's life hangs in the balance. Who is it this time?
It's no fun hanging out here now that your cats are gone. You know I get along better with females.
Chang'an joked as he packed up his bag and put on his shoes. The sneakers weren't that old, but the backs were already worn down. Are you doing a job for Old Raccoon? Ressing asked.
What if I am?
I saw Hunja today. I don't know if it's the upcoming election, but he was an even bigger prick than usual. He said if we don't stop, he would have to kill us. Something about how I'm Old Raccoon's hands and feet and you're his eyes and ears. What a joke. Anyway, after what happened with the old general, Hanja is pretty angry and wants us to lie low until the election is over.
Oh, is our little Ressing scared? If you fall for every bluff in this line of work, how will you get by?
It's worse this time. He'll call off once the election's over, so don't do anything until then.
You know how bored Old Raccoon gets when I don't deliver his newspaper? Besides, that old fox Hanja isn't going to start anything now. He's bluffing. He just wants to scare you. So stop worrying and bring those kitties back. It's not the same here without the ladies. I can't believe the great Ressing evacuated his cats because of an itty-bitty bomb in his toilet. Don't you think you're overreacting?
Halfway out the door, Chang'an stopped and turned, as if he'd just remembered something. He undid his belt and pulled his jeans down.
Hey, check this out. Scorpion brand virility underwear. I got them for 170,000 won. See here. Crystallized jade and yellow clay that emit infrared rays to maximize stamina. It's like I'm wearing Superman's underwear.
Ressing watched, dumbfounded, then said, The guy who owns the corner shop wears those.
Yeah? I bet he says they're amazing, right?
They work so well, he had a stroke. Chang'an pouted as he pulled his jeans back up.
I don't know why I expected to have a productive conversation with someone whose goal in life is to die a virgin. I'm out of here.
Ressing grinned as he watched Chang'an walk away wiggling his butt. Knitting. Ressing had been casing the front of the knitting supply shop for an hour. The sign, Misa's Knitting Room, looked like a child had written it. The shop was on the first floor of a two-story building on the corner of a quiet residential street. The building itself was old and run down, but Misa's knitting room had been renovated, decked out with hardwoods and fabrics to look quaint and charming, like something out of a Disney movie. Printed on the shop window were various advertisements, including knitting, quilting, natural dyes, and crocheting, and great hobby for housewives. At exactly 11 a.m., Misa wheeled up to the shop. A lunch bag dangled from one armrest, and a canvas bag stuffed with fabric and skeins of wool dangled from the other. She dusted off her hands and took out a handkerchief to blot the beads of sweat from her forehead. Mito and Misa's apartment was a brisk 10-minute walk from the shop, with several low hills along the way. Not the easiest of distances for someone in a wheelchair. It had probably taken Misa a good 30 minutes to get to the shop. No wonder she was perspiring. Misa took out her key and unlocked the security gate. She leaned down to retrieve the newspaper and mail sitting in the entrance, flipping through the envelopes before setting them on her lap. She turned her head and gazed briefly at a large 1 cubic meter box a delivery person had left outside the shop. It was clearly too big for her to pick up without the use of her legs. She left the box where it was and went inside. Resen had spent the last several days visiting the suspicious locations Zhang'an had circled on the map, but none of them looked like a secret hideout. Dr. Kang's laboratory was no different from any other faculty office crammed with musty old books and papers, and the spot that Zhang'an had indicated as his potential hideout was empty. That was to be expected. If Dr. Kang had indeed been Hanja's plotter, then the moment Kang was dead, fixers would have been sent in to sweep up every last file. Hanja would never let so much dangerous evidence just sit there. The sister's apartment was likewise unremarkable, except that, while Misa's bedroom was spotlessly clean and well-organized, Mito's room looked like a chimpanzee lived there. The windowsill was covered in panties left to dry. Bras dangled from coat hangers outside the open window. A pair of elephant print pajamas lay crumpled on the bed. And ankle socks, their soles blackened with dirt, were strewn everywhere. Underneath the bed was a pair of old-fashioned boxer shorts, the kind only someone's dad would wear, and a torn condom. Rezeng picked up the boxes, covered in dust and hair, and thought, what kind of idiot takes off so fast that he leaves his underwear behind? On the desk were medical books and a notepad. Rezeng flipped through the notepad, but it contained no evidence that Mito was a plotter. Craziest of all, Zhong'an's claim that Mito was Dr. Kang's assistant had turned out to be nothing more than speculation. Everyone at the university and the research center had looked puzzled by Rezeng's questions.
Mito and Dr. Kang? I thought she was Professor Kim Sonil's research assistant.
Officially, then, it was impossible to say whether Mito and Dr. Kang had been involved with each other. Zhong'an had jumped to conclusions about their relationship simply because Mito had ordered bomb parts and at some point worked in the same lab as he had. Rezeng took out a cigarette. Just as he was about to light it, Misa came back out. She stared grimly at the oversized box and leaned forward to try to lift it. After a few groans, she gave up and tried dragging it. That didn't work, either. Each time she tugged on the box, her wheelchair rolled and threatened to tip her out. After wrestling with it for a while, she paused to wipe her forehead. Rezeng tucked the unlit cigarette back into the pack and walked over to her. "Would you like some help?" he asked. Misa raised her head and stared at him. Her skin was as clean and pure as a baby's, and her eyes as big and innocent-looking as a calf's. She looked at him in surprise, then smiled radiantly, less a smile of gratitude for his kind gesture, and more like she was stifling laughter. What was so funny?
"Why, thank you,"
she said, finally. Rezeng picked up the box. It was definitely too heavy for anyone to manage without using their legs. He waited for instructions from her, but she was still staring at him in blatant amusement. "So, am I just supposed to stand here all day holding this?" he asked. Finally, Misa burst out laughing. What was so funny? Rezeng was seriously confused. Now Misa was laughing so hard, she was crying.
"I'm
sorry,
so sorry. Once I start laughing, I can't stop. Oh my, wow, I don't know what came over me. Please, come in."
She wiped her eyes and opened the door, then skillfully guided the wheelchair between a chair and a sewing machine and pointed to a round wooden table. Rezeng set the box on it.
"You're Rezeng, right?"
Misa asked, the laughter not yet faded from her face. Shocked, Rezeng said, "You know my name?"
"Of course I do. You're my sister's boyfriend. How could I not know your name? We talk about you every day up in the attic."
The words boyfriend, every day, and attic swirled around inside Rezeng's head. What on earth was going on? "Your sister said I'm her boyfriend," he asked.
"What? You're not? Are you another of my sister's crushes?"
Misa now looked like she was going to burst into tears at any second.
"I knew it. I knew she was turning into a stalker again."
Misa picked up a piece of yarn from the table and twisted it around the tip of her finger, then let it drift to the floor. She looked so crestfallen that Rezeng almost felt bad.
"No, I only said that because I thought I was the one with the crush."
"Really?"
Misa's eyes widened. Of course. He smiled at her. Her face immediately lit up like a child's.
Oh, where are my manners? Please have a seat.
She offered him the chair next to her. He sat down, still confused.
Would you like some coffee?
If it's not too much trouble.
Trouble? Don't be silly.
Misa gave him another big smile and wheeled over to a small kitchenette that had been added to the corner of the shop. The sink and counter were set low to accommodate her. While she prepared the coffee, he took a quick look around. Though you might expect a place where people worked with fabric and yarn to be messy, the inside of the shop was as neat and charming as Misa herself. A cabinet along one wall held tidy stacks of cloth, quilting supplies, knitting needles, and yarn, and fabric samples. Displayed on the other wall were tablecloths, aprons, dolls, bags, and other quilted objects. The items all had little labels in pretty handwriting, either for display or for sale. The center shelf, which had a sign that read Petting Zoo, was lined with various stuffed animals. There was pantless Winnie the Pooh, his stomach sticking out, and Chester Cheetah giving the thumbs up, with a speech bubble that read, "You are Zeus, god of the sky. I am Cheetos, god of the snacks." Staring blankly at Resing were Tom and Jerry, Papa Smurf, and a whole gaggle of his Smurf buddies, as well as all the Teletubbies, their arms in the air, as if they were about to lead everyone in a round of calisthenics. Resing caught himself wondering nonsensically, do they belong in a petting zoo? Another shelf, with a sign that said, "The Garden," held a display of quilted cacti, carrots, watermelons, and strawberries.